Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
Welcome to Slate's I Have to Ask. I'm Isaac Chotiner. My guest today is Robert Wright, the best-selling author of books including The Moral Animal, Non-Zero, and The Evolution of God. Those books covered subjects such as the evolutionary roots of human behavior, why globalization and technology have brought us positive change in our relationships and lives, and how religious belief has become increasingly tolerant over time. His new book is called Why Buddhism is True: The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment, and it seeks to explain why Buddhism is so valuable, both to the world and to his own life, and why its core insights reflect real truths about evolution and psychology and human beings. Robert Wright joins me now in studio. Bob, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, that my first paid job in journalism, which was at Blogging Heads TV, which you were the founder of.
You realize you've just undermined the credibility of this entire conversation.
I didn't make enough money that I'm in any sort of debt to you, I think.
That's true. Well, then I may have the opposite problem.
Yes, exactly. Well, I want to talk about many things, including your new book. And the first thing I want to ask you, just for people who may not know much about Buddhism, can you just talk a little bit about what Buddhism is and specifically the variety of Buddhism that you're talking about in this book largely?
Well, first of all, there's religious Buddhism, which this book isn't about. This book is about what you might call the naturalistic or secular part of Buddhism. So it's not about reincarnation, and it's not about prayers and so on. It is about the central claim of Buddhist philosophy, which is that the reason we suffer and the reason we make other people suffer is because we don't see the world clearly. And Buddhist practice, including meditation, can be seen as a program for seeing the world more clearly. With a title like Why Buddhism is True, you have to get clear at some point on what you mean. And that's the main thing I mean when I say, I mean more than that, but I certainly mean to affirm that part of the Buddhist claim.
Well, it seems like you write in the book that you wondered if there was a way to put the actual truth about human nature and the human condition into a form that would not just identify and explain the illusions we labor under, but would help us liberate ourselves from them. And so one of the things that you're doing in the book is you're talking about these illusions, and you're sort of explaining how science gives us some reason to understand why we have these illusions, and that Buddhism and science in this sense sort of coexist or teach us the same thing. Can you talk a little bit about that? And then I want to ask you some specifics about it.
Yeah, well, I had written in the past about evolutionary psychology. And one thing that struck me is that actually the human mind was not designed by natural selection to see the world clearly per se. I mean, that's not the bottom line. The bottom line is like what psychological tendencies got the genes of our ancestors into subsequent generations. Now, often doing that involves seeing the world clearly. You want to have a pretty clear visual picture of the world generally, but not in all respects. So, you know, if deceiving, if having a mind that is deceived or that has a distorted view of things will get genes into the next generation, then distortion will be built into the mind.
And so what would be an example of that?
Well, you know, Buddhism makes two really radical seeming claims. When you kind of drill down on what Buddhists mean by we don't see the world clearly, one thing they mean is that we don't see ourselves clearly at all. And in fact, Buddhism goes so far as to say we're confused about the very existence of a self. There is a sense in which the self doesn't exist, which is pretty radical. And then there's also a claim about how kind of deluded we are about the world out there, that the people and the objects we see, we tend to have a distorted view of, we attribute to them a kind of essence that isn't there. And both of these claims, you know, may sound strong, but I think there's a lot more to be said for them than you might imagine. And I think evolutionary psychology explains why we do suffer from these particular distortions. So
take one about food, which you bring up in the book.
Okay, well, food. Now, here we get
like to... Like chocolate.
Right, yeah. So chocolate, which I remain a fan of, as I was before I started meditating. I mean, here we get to another of the kind of central claims of Buddhism, very central, that in a way, you know, is related to the other things I've said about what Buddhism is, but the idea that at the root of suffering is what the Buddha in the native tongue was tanha, or like thirst, craving, for not just food, but for material attainments, for status, for sex, for everything that we crave. And the illusion there is that lasting gratification will ensue, or even that it will endure for very long. It actually tends not to, right? And we tend to pursue things as if they will be more deeply and enduringly gratified than they are. The Buddha stressed their impermanence, that they would evaporate. And I think evolutionary psychology, again, explains why they evaporate. I mean...
And why they exist. Why our craving for chocolate?
Well, sure. You have to have... Organisms have to be motivated from natural selection's point of view, but to do things, to nourish themselves, to do whatever will get genes spread, like sex, but they can't be enduringly happy with these things, or they wouldn't sit around and get busy. You know, it's a dog eat dog world out there. So the fleetingness of pleasure is a product of natural selection, and we're learning more about the brain chemistry of it, and I talk a little about that, but you know, that's another example. And the idea behind mindfulness meditation is your thirsts, your cravings, and various other feelings you view, you could say with greater detachment, although that's in a way misleading, than usual. But the idea in general with mindfulness meditation, which is the kind I focus on in the book, is to, rather than be driven by your feelings, examine them and decide which feelings you think are offering good guidance and which aren't.
So if I really want to eat, you know, my second ice cream sundae of the day, you in the book, you don't think that the way to do that is to sort of repress it necessarily, but to sort of think about why I have that desire for it and why, in fact, it may not make me that happy to have a second ice cream. Is that correct?
Well, not just to think about it. And in fact, I mean, I came out of my kind of study of evolutionary psychology very aware that knowing about the problem of human nature by itself doesn't solve the problem, because the various... Because, you know, the craving, not just that the cravings are so strong, but that in general, feelings so subtly infiltrate our thought and our motivation that it's hard to even be aware of them. So, you know, mindfulness meditation is a practice for getting better at seeing what's driving you and deciding consciously whether you want to be driven in exactly that way. So, you know, that's why I think it's interesting that Buddhism, you know, a couple thousand years before Darwin, diagnosed the human predicament in ways that make a lot of sense in terms of evolutionary psychology. and also came up with a prescription, a program that, you know, it's not trivially easy to follow by any means. Then again, it's a difficult problem, but a program that I think works in a kind of pragmatic therapeutic sense, but beyond that can take you into really, I think, interesting philosophical and I would say spiritual territory. You know, I've been on like meditation retreats, a number of them where you really just do nothing but meditate all day, no contact with the outside world. And in that context, you can really go to some interesting places.
One of the things that you write about in your book, just to move off things like chocolate, is anger. And you talk about why, in a certain way, we sometimes get pleasure from anger and, you know, some incident of road rage or something, that being angry really brings us some sort of some joy, but that it's, again, it's not long lasting. And so I was wondering, in your own life, how do you feel like Buddhism has helped you with anger?
Well, I'm as prone to rage as the next person.
I worked for you. I know this.
I forget. Was I a very well-behaved boss?
I have no comment.
I contend that there are worse bosses. Some of them occupy very high positions, even as we speak.
Yes, that I would agree with.
But yeah, I'm like, well, first of all, I'm not a natural meditator. I'm not good at paying attention and focusing on things. And secondly, I need it. And this is a problem. People who need meditation the most tend not to be naturals at it, right? Because they don't have a lot of natural equanimity. Rage, I mean, first of all, rage is an interesting example because it, in a certain sense, made more sense in the environment of our evolution, a hunter-gatherer environment, than it makes now. I mean, the point of rage from natural selection's point of view is to demonstrate that people can't mess with you. So if you disrespect me, if you try to steal my mate, whatever, I will fight you. And even if I lose the fight, I have sent a signal to everyone in my social environment that I am willing to pay the price to make sure that people who exploit me suffer. Now, in a modern environment, like road rage, and there actually recently was an actual death by gunshot in a road rage case, it doesn't even make that much sense, right? I mean, because there's nobody who's ever going to see you again who's witnessing the rage. There's no point at all in the demonstration of your resolve. So
it's not going to help you on Tinder if you put on your profile that you just like shot someone on the freeway.
No, yeah. It could be. Yeah, there could be active downside to beyond the risk of getting shot. But I do think, I mean, one thing an evolution perspective can do is highlight the absurdity of some of our feelings, and so reinforce the idea that it's worth learning how to examine them carefully, and cultivating the ability to not be driven by them should you choose not to.
And so how has that worked for you? You talk in the book about a former colleague who it would make you angry sometimes to think about, or what the way that person.
I do not mention the person's name.
You do not. You come up with a fake name for the person.
I do.
But how did thinking about this person in this different way after you started meditating change the way you thought about him?
Well, I was just meditating once. This was during a retreat. And for some reason, he came to mind. And, you know, I don't have a lot of just bitter enemies. I mean, I would say there are. Two or three people in the category I would put this person in. And I was meditating, and I don't know why I started thinking of him, but just suddenly I had a very charitable view. Suddenly I was like imagining him as like a gangly, awkward adolescent, like not fitting in on the playground and developing the various tendencies that in my view are not entirely commendable and in any event have rubbed me the wrong way. But it was just the first time I've ever thought of this person in a charitable way. And that's some kind of testament to the kind of distance you can get on your more reflexive reactions to things.
How do you feel about anger and rage in terms of people who, say, are reading the newspaper now and seeing what's going on in the world? I mean, what do you think sort of the appropriate response is?
Very interesting question. I'm thinking about, and I may have done this by the time the podcast airs, who knows, trying to get the phrase mindful resistance off the ground. Maybe, I don't know, podcast called Mindful Resistance that competes with yours or something, who knows. But the idea, I personally think that the reaction to Trump is excessive. I mean, for tactical purposes, that I don't think we realize how often our outrage actually feeds his base and serves his goal of keeping support at least high enough that, like, he can't get impeached, for example. And I just think in a lot of ways, and I'm as prone to this as the next person, you know, clicking retweet on something that actually doesn't have much nutritional value.
Well, I guess I ask because I was thinking about Don Jr. the other day and sort of trying to get in my mind to feel bad for him and thinking, like, here's this guy who grew up with this insane father and he's always wanted to please him and he can't, and maybe we should have sympathy for him. And part of me still thinks that's the way to think about these things. But I also feel like this is a guy who's been in bed with these white supremacist forces on the internet. This is a guy who's going along with the pillaging of our country. Well, there seems something about anger that I don't want to lose, even
right.
and I wonder how you, if you think that's right and how you feel about that.
No, it's a real challenge. I mean, righteous indignation is a powerful motivator and it can be harnessed for good. We just need to be mindful that our conception of what's righteous is kind of naturally warped. You need to very carefully examine, I think, your commitments, kind of your kind of value commitments or whatever, to make sure that you're not being led astray by the parts of human nature that tend to lead us astray, or that you're just not just overreacting in a counterproductive way. But it absolutely is a challenge. And I, to be honest, I've known people who went so far down the meditative path that although they had the same views that they had about social justice or whatever, the same views they'd ever had, still, they seemed a little more complacent than I thought was optimal. I think that's an actual danger. You want to be, you know, you want to think about it. But I don't think I'm anywhere near there. My problem in general with politics and ideology is keeping my rage below the counterproductive level. I need meditation even to do that.
I want to ask, you talk about hatred and rage as at a geopolitical level, too, in the book. You write, I'm just going to read something that you wrote from the book. At some level, it's always the same things. Human beings operating under the influence of human brains whose design presupposed their specialness. That is, human beings operating under the influence of the reality distortion fields that control us in many and subtle ways, convincing us that we and ours are in the right, that we are by nature good. And you put forward this attitude as one of the reasons that violence happened and wars happen and so on. I think that there's obviously some truth to that, but don't you think that wars are often driven by sort of not even thinking consciously like we are in the right, but by religious faith or by, which again is a form of thinking that we are in the right, but it's also, I wonder if it's even that when you're a true religious believer fighting a war for partially religious reasons, whether you're even thinking about it in those conscious terms that you're putting forward.
Well, first of all, I think, you know, religious violence is just a subset of groupish violence. I mean, the key dynamics there are identifying with a group, seeing the world from its point of view and processing all information through that prism. And I think it goes well beyond, like, just, you know, the kind of intuition that we're in the right. It involves processing all the information in ways that reinforce that idea. So, you know, confirmation bias is now a famous thing. Well, I think that's built into us by natural selection, and it's very hard to overcome. And you know, you can hear about it and then find your, I should say, confirmation bias, and you know, is just seeing the evidence consistent with your thesis or that serves your group's arguments and not seeing evidence against it. And I think this happens on both sides of the kind of Trump divide right now. It's a deeply human thing. And I actually think mindfulness meditation makes you somewhat more resistant to it, in part because you become aware of the feelings that drive it. You become aware that, like, when you see a piece of information that's consistent with the argument you want to make, it feels good. It's almost like being attracted to food or something. I mean, that information feels good. And this is how subtle a level all these controls operate at. And I think it's that level that meditation can help you live at and help you, you know, it can help you discern the biases that are at that level. So it's not about, like, raw aggression. It's not about just, hey, I'm right and you're wrong. it's about subtle biases on perception that go way beyond what I've described.
Do you think you've gotten a better sense of why people like Trump, assuming you don't?
Well, three of my four siblings voted for Trump. So on the other hand, I've pretty much avoided talking to them about it. So I don't claim that I've gotten a lot of insight there. But I do think, I mean, you know, there is the natural tendency to want to demonize the people on the other side of the fight. So it is natural and easy to say they are racist, they are stupid, and so on. And I just think it's more complicated than that. There are some true racists, but I think you're not serving your own cause when you succumb to the tendency to demonize people in that way. Because I think, you know, if you're going to undermine Trump's support, you're going to need to understand what the source of that support is. And, you know,
that's a very pragmatically political way of looking at it, though, that if we, you know, if you want Trump to lose in 2020, that you have to reach some people who voted for him, so on. But what about from a larger sense of just put aside the political consequences for a minute? I mean, do you think that what we need is more sympathy for people who vote in different directions and so on?
First, the one term I would use is cognitive empathy. In other words, perspective taking, not necessarily feeling their pain or even caring about them, just understanding what the world looks like from their point of view. And again, I think meditation can really facilitate that. It can break down your natural tendency to want to dismiss or demonize them. Now, once you do that and understand what their situation in life is and what their frustrations are, you may then feel deeply that, yeah, some of these problems they face should be addressed. And so cognitive empathy may lead to sympathy, but I think the first step is just to see the situation clearly, and our brains naturally discourage that.
We got sidetracked briefly. I just wanted to ask you, going back to your previous books, when you started writing Non-Zero, what year did that book come out? 99?
Came out in 2000.
In 2000. So that was obviously a very different time in sort of our feelings about the internet and about globalization. And I was just wondering, separate from Buddhism issues and this book, are your feelings about global connectivity and the role of the internet in fostering a communal environment, have they changed in the past couple decades? And if so, how?
Not a lot. That book was taken as more optimistic than I meant it. And in fact, when I saw that in the hardcover, I changed the paperback a little bit to reinforce the fact that I wasn't saying a happy ending is assured. Yes, technology has moved us toward a global level of social organization, but a happy ending is far from assured. In some ways, information technology does tribalize us. I said that in the book. And so there will be these two forces contending, you know, tribalization and globalization. And it's, you know, the jury's out. I still feel that way. I do feel that this book is part of the program. I mean, mindfulness meditation is not the only way to gain, you know, a clearer perspective on things and wind up interacting with people more productively. But I think it's a good way.
I want to close by talking a little bit about religion, because you started this podcast by saying, I'm not talking about religious Buddhism per se, but when you close the book, you talk about this very subject and you ask, is the type of Buddhism I'm practicing in fact a religion? And so I was just wondering, I mean, because that's, how do you feel about it sitting here today? Is the type of Buddhism you're practicing a form of religion?
Well, it kind of feels like that to me. I mean, I certainly consider it spiritual in some reasonable definitions of that term. The thing I say in that chapter about religion is, you know, William James said generically religion is certainly centrally involves the idea that there is an unseen order and that our supreme interest lies in harmoniously adjusting ourselves to that order. And Buddhism, set aside the religious part, but just philosophical Buddhism does posit the existence of a kind of order. I mean, a couple of kinds, but one kind is that there is a natural convergence between seeing the world more clearly, seeing the truth, becoming happier, and becoming a better person. So that's three different things, right? Clarity of vision, happiness, and moral edification, becoming a better person. And the assertion by Buddhist philosophy is that conveniently, those are all the same thing. If you if you get on the path, including a meditative path, and seriously pursue it, you will be making progress on all three fronts. At least they will tend to coincide. And I think that's basically true. I mean, there are people of great meditative attainment who are bad people. That's possible. But I think by and large, this kind of amazing claim about the way the universe is set up, that you get kind of three for one, I think is true. Now, so there is a kind of unseen order, whether that in people who agree that it's there would inspire something like religious awe, or, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's partly a question of how you define the terms. But for me, it's an interesting and motivating thing.
Have you thought more since you started meditating about just the existence of God? And because I know it's a subject you've thought about and written about for a long time in your work. Is your opinion of that changed at all? Like, where are you on that?
Subject? Yeah. Could we, before we close, could we settle a God question?
You have 60 seconds.
Okay. I mean, my position has, is brought up Christian. I'm not a Christian. I have made the argument. It's not made in this book. And when I make it, it gets me into trouble. So I don't make it that often. But I have made the argument that there is some reason to suspect that there is some larger purpose unfolding through material evolution. I'm not talking about anything spooky, any guiding force. I'm just talking about nuts and bolts, natural selection, and the technological evolution that it gives birth to. You could look at some kind of directional tendencies in those processes and say, well, it almost looks like there's some point to this exercise, even though that doesn't necessarily mean the exercise was set in motion by a god. We don't know what might have set it in motion. But I think there are grounds for speculation. But I totally set that aside in this book. I'm really focusing on Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist psychology.
And what's your current meditative practice today?
I meditate half an hour each morning, sometimes more. Things go better when I meditate more.
You can feel it every day, the days you meditate?
Yeah, I can feel the difference usually. I can definitely feel that, you know, if things are like I'm having trouble writing and my instinct is like, well, why don't you go get some more food or something, you know, that actually if I just sit down and meditate for 10 or 15 minutes, that actually solves the problem very often and restores focus. And yet, oddly, it's still hard to convince yourself to do that rather than go get food.
Oh, well, it's a story of being a person, I guess.
It is.
Bob Wright, thank you so much for joining me. The book is Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Isaac.
And that's our show for today. I Have to Ask is produced by Audrey Dilling. Our theme music was composed by Doug Chase. One last thing for my Bay Area listeners, and I hope I have some of them because I'm recording this in the Bay Area. On September 26th, that's a Tuesday, at 7 p.m. at Books, Inc. at 601 Van Ness in San Francisco, I'm going to be hosting my former boss, Franklin Foer, who's now a writer for The Atlantic, and he's the author of a new book. It's called World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. I'm going to be interviewing him about the book. We're going to talk about tech issues. We're going to talk about journalism. We're going to talk about some of his reporting on Trump and Russia and all kinds of things. And we're going to do it right in the heart of tech world. So please join us if you can. That's a live taping of I Have to Ask on Tuesday, September 26th at Books, Inc. in San Francisco.